In 1993, a young engineer named Jeff Bezos had the idea to sell books online. He called his new company Amazon and warned many of his early investors, which included his parents, that there was a 70% chance the venture would either fail or go bankrupt. 25 years later, it's very clear that Bezos' idea did not fail. Amazon not only survived, it thrived, weathering the dot-com bubble and eventually expanding to become the world's largest online sales company and the world's largest provider of cloud infrastructure services. According to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, Amazon's success has made Bezos the wealthiest person in the world, with a net worth of nearly $160 billion, which he's using to fund his space company, Blue Origin, and contributing to charity, including his recent pledge to spend $2 billion to help homeless families. Bezos recently sat down with Carlyle Group co-founder David Rubenstein. They spoke on David Rubenstein's Bloomberg television program, Peer-to-Peer Conversations.
Your stock is actually up 70% this year. Is there one thing that you think is responsible for that, or several things? Because 70% is pretty good.
Now, I have been lecturing. We have all hands meetings at Amazon, and for 20 years, ever since we've been public, 21 years now, in 1997, at almost every all hands meeting, I said, "Look, when the stock is up 30% in a month, don't feel 30% smarter." Because when the stock is down 30% in a month, it's not going to feel so good to feel 30% dumber. And that's what happens. Never spend any time thinking about the daily stock price. I don't.
Okay. So as a result of going up 70% this year, you have become the wealthiest man in the world. Is that a title that you really wanted or not?
Assure you I have never sought that title. And it was fine being the second wealthiest person in the world. That actually worked fine. It's something people naturally are curious about. You know, it's a kind of an interesting curiosity. But it's not the thing. I would much rather if they said, like, inventor Jeff Bezos or entrepreneur Jeff Bezos or, father Jeff Bezos. Those kinds of things are much more meaningful to me. And it's an output measure. If you look at the financial success of Amazon and the stock, I own 16% of Amazon. Amazon's worth roughly $1 trillion. That means that what we have built over 20 years, we have built $840 billion of wealth for other people. And that's great. That's how it should be. You know, there I believe so powerfully in the ability of entrepreneurial capitalism and free markets to solve so many of the world's problems. Not all of them, but so many of them.
So you live in Washington State, near in Seattle,
yeah.
Or outside of Seattle. Now, the man who was the richest man for about 20 years is named Bill Gates.
Yeah.
And what is the likelihood that the two richest men in the world live not only in the same country, not only in the same state, not only in the same city, but in the same neighborhood? I mean, is there something in that neighborhood that we should know about? And are there any more houses for sale there?
After I saw Bill not too long ago, we were joking about the world's richest man thing, and I basically said thank you. I said you're welcome, and he immediately turned to me and said thank you. Medina is a great little it's a suburb of Seattle, and I don't think there's anything special in the water there. And
okay.
I did locate Amazon in Seattle because of Microsoft. I thought that big pool of technical talent would provide a good place to recruit talented people from, and that did turn out to be true. So it's not a complete coincidence. There's some correlation there.
Do you go into a store, when you want to buy something, do you have to put a credit card down? You just say, I'm Jeff Bezos, and they send you the stuff? How do you do that? And do you have to carry cash around, or you carry
something? Yeah, I do carry cash. And I have credit cards, yeah.
And if your credit card...
I have to show my driver's license and,
But have you ever had a credit card denied? No, has that ever happened?
I have. I've had my credit card denied.
So what do you say when you say, don't you know who I am?
I give them another credit card. I say, here, try this one.
Okay. So you made an announcement that is the most significant philanthropic gift you've made in this type. It was a... About a year ago, you said you were, wanted to look for some good philanthropic ideas, and you got, I think, 47,000 of them, and you reviewed them. And how did you decide where to put this $2 billion? And would you describe exactly what you're going to do?
Well, that process was very helpful. So I solicited ideas, kind of crowdsourced, and I got literally, as you said, something like 47,000, maybe even a little more. Some of them came to my inbox. Most of them came on social media. And I read through thousands and thousands of them. My office kind of correlated them all and put them into buckets. And there were some themes that emerged. But the other thing that's fascinating about the kind of exercise is you see just how long-tailed it is. People are interested in trying to help the world in so many different ways. A lot of people are very interested in homelessness, including me. A lot of people are very interested in education of all kinds. I'm very interested in early education, and the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. My mother has become, in running the Bezos Family Foundation, she has become an expert in early education. I'm a student of Montessori schools. I started at Montessori when I was 2 years old, and the teacher complained to my mother, the Montessori school teacher complained to my mother that I was too task-focused and that she couldn't get me to switch tasks, so she would have to just pick up my chair and move me. Huh? And by the way, I think that's, if you ask the people who work with me, that's still probably true. But
did that teacher ever call you since and said she was responsible for your success? Did she ever call you?
No? No, I'm in touch with several of my high school and elementary school teachers, though, but I don't know any of my Montessori school teachers.
Okay. So the gift that you're giving, essentially, you're going to have some for preschool for children who need preschool, free preschool.
Yeah, full tuition preschool, Montessori inspired. I'm very excited about that because I'm going to operate that. That's going to be an operating nonprofit, and we're going to put them in low-income neighborhoods. We know for a fact that if a kid falls behind, it's really, really hard to catch up. And if you can give somebody a leg up when they're 2, 3, or 4 years old, by the time they get to kindergarten or first grade, they're much less likely to fall behind. It can still happen, but you've really improved their odds. The money spent there is going to pay gigantic dividends for decades.
The other part of your gift will be to give awards out to...
Yes, and that's going to be more traditional grant-making philanthropy. So there, I'm going to identify, with the help of a team, identify and fund, vet and fund... family homeless shelters.
And that will be, you said you would give an initial $2 billion.
Yeah.
You expect to add to that?
Yeah, it's day one. Everything I've ever done has started small. Amazon started with a couple of people, and Blue Origin started with 5 people, and the budget at Blue Origin was very, very small. Now the budget at Blue Origin approaches $1 billion a year. And next year, it'll be more than $1 billion. And Amazon, it literally was 10 people. Today, it's 500,000 people. But it's hard to remember for you guys. But for me, it's like yesterday. I was driving the packages to the post office myself and hoping one day we could afford a forklift. And so for me, I've seen small things get big. And it's part of this day one mentality. I like treating things as if they're small. You know, Amazon, even though it is a large company, I wanted to have the heart and spirit of a small one. And so anyway, that the Day One Foundation is going to be like that. We'll wander a little bit too. So we have some very specific ideas of what we want to do, but I believe in the power of wandering. All of my best decisions in business and in life have been made with heart, intuition, guts, analysis. When you can make a decision with analysis, you should do so. But it turns out in life that your most important decisions are always made with instinct, intuition, taste, heart. And that's what we'll do with this Day One Foundation, too. Right. And the customer is going to be the child. This is so important because the secret sauce of Amazon, where there are several principles at Amazon, but the number one thing that has made us successful by far is obsessive compulsive focus on the customer as opposed to obsession over the competitor. And I talk so often to other CEOs and some other CEOs and also founders and entrepreneurs. And I can tell that even though they're talking about customers, they're really focusing on competitors. And it is a huge advantage to any company if you can stay focused on your customer instead of your competitor. So then you have to identify who is your customer. So at the Washington Post, for example, is the customer the people who buy advertisements from us? No, the customer is the reader. And in the school, who are the customers? Is it the parents? Is it the teachers? No, it is the child. And that's what we're gonna do. We're gonna be obsessively, compulsively focused on the child. We're gonna be scientific when we can be, and we're gonna use heart and intuition when we need to.
When you use your intuition to make decisions, where is the intuition leading you now on your second headquarters?
All right. Can we just take a moment to acknowledge that may be the best segue in the history of interviewing.
All right.
Seriously, David, so, that is
all right.
That's so amazing.
The answer is
very simple. We will announce a decision before the end of this year. So we've made tremendous progress. The team is working their butts off on it. And we will get there. No. Hey, be nice. Come on.
Why did you buy the Washington Post? You had no background in that area. Yeah. What convinced you to do that?
Okay, first of all, I was not looking for a newspaper. I had no intention of buying a newspaper. I had never thought about the idea. It had never occurred to me. It was never something. It wasn't like a childhood dream. No, nothing. And my friend, Don Graham, who at that time I had known 15 years, I know him 20 years now, He approached me through an intermediary and wanted to know if I would be interested in buying the Washington Post. And I sent back word that I would not because I didn't really know anything about newspapers. And Don, over a series of conversations, convinced me that that was unimportant because we had, inside the Washington Post, we have so much talent that understands newspapers. That wasn't what the problem was. What they needed was somebody who had an understanding of the internet. And so that was the first thing. That's kind of how it got started. And then I did some soul searching. And again, my decision-making process, something like this would definitely be intuition and not analysis. The financial situation of the Washington Post at that time, this is 2013, was very upside down. The problem was a secular one. The internet was just eroding all of the traditional advantages that local newspapers had, all of them. And I said, is this something I want to get involved in? If I'm going to do it, I'm going to put some heart into it and some work into it. And I decided I would only do that if I really believed it was an important institution. And I said to myself, if this were a financially upside down, salty snack food company, the answer would be no. As soon as I started thinking about it that way, I was like, this is an important institution. It is the newspaper in the capital city of the most important country in the world. The Washington Post has an incredibly important role to play in this democracy. There's just no doubt in my mind about that. And so as soon as I had passed through that gate, I only had one more gate that I had to go through before telling Don yes, and that was I wanted to look myself, be really open with myself and look in a mirror and sort of think about the company and be sure that I was optimistic that it could work because, if it were hopeless, that would also be not something I would get involved in. And I looked at that, and I was super optimistic. And it needed to be transitioned to a national and a global publication. There's one gift that the internet brings newspapers, and that is free global distribution. So we had to take advantage of that gift, and that was the basic strategy. We had to switch from a business model where we made a lot of money per reader with a relatively small number of readers, to a little bit, tiny bit of money per reader on a very large number of readers. And that's the transition that we did over last night. I'm pleased to report to you that the Post is profitable today. The newsroom is growing. It's been growing every year since I've been there. It's working, and I'm so proud of that team. And I know for a fact when I'm 80, or let's say, I always project myself forward to age 80, but as I get older, I'm starting to do 90. So I know that when I'm 90, It's going to be one of the things I'm most proud of is that I took on the Washington Post and helped them through a very rough transition.
So when you agreed to buy it, I think the asking price was $250 million. You negotiate?
No. Don, I asked him how much he wanted. He said $250. I said, fine. I didn't negotiate with him, and I did no due diligence. And I wouldn't need to with Don. He told me I have something I'd like to sell.
Now that you own the Washington Post, sometimes there are some people who criticize some things that the Washington Post says. And you've been remarkably quiet.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, you've been remarkably quiet in not defending yourself.
Well, I do defend the Post. It is a mistake for any elected official, in my opinion. I don't think this is a very out there opinion, to attack media and journalists. I believe that it is an essential component of our democracy. There has never been, I was going to say never been an elected official who liked their headlines. I think there's probably no public figure who has ever liked their headlines. It's okay. It's part of the process. You know, it's if you're the president of the United States or a governor of a state or whatever, you don't take that job thinking you're not going to get scrutinized. You're going to get scrutinized, and it's healthy. And somebody very what the president should say is, this is right, this is good, I'm glad I'm being scrutinized, and that would be so secure and confident. But it's really dangerous to demonize the media, it's dangerous to call the media lowlifes, it's dangerous to say that they're the enemy of the people. We live in a society where it's not just the laws of the land that protect us. We do have freedom of press, it's in the Constitution. But it's also the social norms that protect us. It works because we believe those words on that piece of paper. And every time you attack that, you're eroding it a little bit around the edges. Now look, I don't want to be dramatic here. We are so robust in this country, the media is going to be fine.
Let's talk about how you came to the situation where you are today. So, you grew up in Texas initially.
Yes.
And from early age, were you a pretty smart student? And your teachers tell you this, you know, you were good? Or
I have always been academically smart. And that, you know, by the way, the older I get, I realize how many kinds of smart there are. Right. There are a lot of kinds of smart. There are a lot of kinds of stupid, too.
Right. But
there are, you know, I see people all the time who I know they wouldn't have gotten A pluses on, you know, their calculus exams, but they're incredibly smart. But yes, I was a very good student.
Right. So you ultimately moved to high school in Miami, and then you were valedictorian of your class. And then you gave a speech as the valedictorian saying you thought we should colonize space or something like that?
I did. It was 1982. I graduated from high school in 1982. Big public high school, Miami Palmetto Senior High, go Panthers. There were 750 kids in my graduating class. And I loved high school. I had so much fun. We had, I lost my library privileges because I laughed too loudly in the library. And
what about that laugh? Where did you get that laugh from? You know, it is distinctive.
I've had that laugh all my life. There was a multi-year period where my brother and sister would not see a movie with me because they thought it was too embarrassing. But I don't know why I have this laugh. And I laugh easily and often. The people who know me, you know, you ask my mom or anybody who knows me well, and they'll say, if Jeff's unhappy, wait 5 minutes.
You graduated as valedictorian, and you decided to go to Princeton. How come you decided to go to Princeton?
Because I wanted to be a theoretical physicist. I changed my major very quickly to electrical engineering and computer science.
But you graduated summa cum laude.
I graduated summa cum laude.
Phi Beta Kappa.
Phi Beta Kappa.
And then you went into the highest calling of mankind, finance.
Yes. I went to New York City, and I ended up working at a quantitative hedge fund run by a brilliant man named David Shaw, D.E. Shaw & Co. I learned so much from him. I used a lot of his ideas and principles on things like HR and recruiting and what kind of people to hire when I started.
It's a very, very good, well-known hedge fund, and you were a star there, as I understand. What propelled you to say, I'm quitting this, I'm going to start a company selling books over the internet, and I'm going to do it from Seattle? Where did that idea come from?
I came across the fact So this is 1994. Nobody has heard of the internet. Very, very few people. And I came across the fact that the web, World Wide Web, was growing at something like 2,300% a year. This is in 1994. And anything growing that fast is, even if its baseline usage today is tiny, it's growing so fast, it's going to be big. And so I looked at that and I was like, there's got to be, I should come up with a business idea and that get, you know, on the internet and then let the internet grow around this and we can keep working on it. And so I made a list of products that I might sell online and I started force ranking them. And I picked books because books is super unusual in one respect, which is that there are more book items in the book category than there are items in any other category. There are 3 million different books active and in print around the world at any given time. So the founding idea of Amazon was to build universal selection of books. The biggest bookstores only had 150,000 titles. And so that's what I did. And I hired a small team, and we built the software. I moved to Seattle.
I mean, you told your parents you were going to quit D.E. Shaw, where you're successful, making presumably a fair amount of money.
Yeah.
And you told your wife, Mackenzie, that you're going to move across the country. What did they all say?
They were immediately and reflexively supportive right after they asked the question, what's the internet?
Right.
And but this is right. You know, with your loved ones, you bet on them. You're not betting on the idea. You are betting on the person. And that was and it's one of those decisions that I made with my heart and not my head. And I basically said, I don't want to regret. When I'm 80, now 90, I want to have minimized the number of regrets that I have in my life. And most of our regrets are acts of omission. They're things we didn't try. It's the path untraveled. Those are the things that haunt us.
And you were telling me that you had to go deliver the books to the post office yourself.
I don't still deliver to the post office, but I was doing that for years.
And I
was packing boxes on my hands and knees. In the first month, I was packing boxes on my hands and knees on the hard cement floors. And with somebody else standing next to me, kneeling next to me, we're packing. And I said, you know what we need? Knee pads. This is killing my knees. And this guy packing alongside me said, we need packing tables. And I was like, oh, that's the most brilliant idea I've ever heard. And the next day I went and bought packing tables and it like doubled our productivity. Think about it, as a senior executive, what do you really get paid to do? You get paid to make a small number of high quality decisions.
What propelled you to sell things more than books?
After books, we started selling music, and then we started selling videos. And then I got smart, and I emailed 1,000 randomly selected customers and asked them, besides the things we sell today, what would you like to see us sell? And that answer came back incredibly long-tailed. The way they answered the question was with whatever they were looking for at that moment. So like I remember one of the answers was, I wish you sold windshield wiper blades because I really need windshield wiper blades. And I thought to myself, we can sell anything this way. And then we launched electronics and toys and many other categories over time. And the vision became, because you read the original business plan, it's just books.
Your stock at one point, I think, went to $100, but then it went down to $6 or something like that.
At the peak of the internet bubble, our stock peaked somewhere around $113. Okay. And then after the internet bubble busted open, our stock went down to $6. It went from $113 to $6 in less than a year. So my annual shareholder that year starts with a one-word sentence, and that one-word sentence is the word ouch.
So most of those internet companies of the dot-com era are out of business.
Yeah.
You survived. What was it that made you to survive and virtually the rest of them are gone?
That whole period is very interesting because the stock is not the company and the company is not the stock. And so as I watched the stock fall from 113 to 6, I was also watching all of our internal business metrics, number of customers, profit per unit, everything you can imagine, defects, etc. Every single thing about the business was getting better and fast. And so as the stock price was going the wrong way, everything inside the company was going the right way. And we didn't need to go back to the capital markets. We didn't need more money. The only reason, a financial bust like the internet bubble bursting is, you know, it makes it really hard to raise money. But, you know, we already had the money we needed, so we just needed to continue to progress.
Well, Wall Street kept saying, well, Amazon's not making any money. They're just getting customers. Where's the profits? Where are the profits? And Wall Street kept beating you up on that, and your response was, I don't really care what you think.
Amazon was, people always accused us of selling dollar bills for 90 cents and said, look, anybody can do that and grow revenues. That's not what we're doing. We always had positive gross margins. It's a fixed cost business. And so what I could see is that from the internal metrics is that at a certain volume level, that we would cover our fixed costs and the company would be profitable.
So who came up with the idea of Prime? Prime seems to be a great way to get money in advance of people actually getting the services.
Yeah.
Whose idea
actually,
was that?
Actually, it's very interesting. So like many inventions inside of a team, and I love team inventing is my favorite thing. So I tap dance into the office. I love Amazon. I have so much fun there. I love Blue Origin. I love the Washington Post. But Amazon is my full-time job. And I get to invent. I get to live 2 to 3 years in the future. And most of the invention we do there is, you know, if somebody has an idea and then other people improve the idea and other people come up with objections why it can never work, and then we solve those objections. And it's a very fun process. We're always wondering, what could a loyalty program be? And then actually a junior software engineer came up with this idea, not as a loyalty program, but this idea that we could offer people kind of an all-you-can-eat buffet of fast free shipping. And when we modeled that, so then, you know, the finance team went and modeled that idea. And the results were horrifying, that we would offer unlimited shipping. Shipping is expensive. And customers love free shipping. But we could see, I mean, again, back to that, you have to use heart and intuition. There has to be risk taking. You have to have instinct. All the good decisions have to be made that way. You do it with a group. You do it with great humility. Because, by the way, getting it wrong isn't that bad. That's the other thing. When we make mistakes, and we've made doozies like the Fire Phone and many other things that just didn't work out, we don't have enough time for me to list all of our failed experiments. But the big winners pay for thousands of failed experiments. So you try something like Prime, and it was very expensive at the beginning. It cost us a lot of money. Because what happens when you offer a free all-you-can-eat buffet? Who shows up to the buffet first? The heavy eaters. It's scary. It's like, oh my God, did I really say as many prawns as you can eat? Oh. And so that is what happened. But surely we could see the trend lines. We could see that, you know, all kinds of customers were coming and they appreciated that service.
You sit around with your team and so forth, but you don't like meetings before 10 a.m.
No.
You like to get 8 hours of sleep and
yes.
You don't like PowerPoints. Explain all that. Why is that?
Okay. I like to putter in the morning. I get up early. I go to bed early. I get up early. I like to putter in the morning. So I like to read the newspaper. I like to have coffee. I like to have breakfast with my kids before they go to school. So I have my kind of puttering time is very important to me. And so that's why I set my first meeting for 10 o'clock. I like to do my high IQ meetings before lunch. Like anything that's going to be really mentally challenging, that's a 10 o'clock meeting. And because by 5 p.m., I'm like, I can't think about that today. Let's try this again tomorrow at 10 a.m. And so then on sleep, I get 8 hours of sleep. I prioritize it. Unless I'm traveling in different time zones, sometimes it's impossible. But I am very focused on it. For me, I need 8 hours of sleep. I think better. I have more energy. My mood is better. All these things. And think about it. As a senior executive, what do you really get paid to do? As a senior executive, you get paid to make a small number of high-quality decisions. Your job is not to make thousands of decisions every day. Is that really worth it if the quality of those decisions might be lower because you're tired or grouchy or any number of things? Now, it's different if it's a startup company. I mean, you know, you're really, you know, when Amazon was 100 people, oh. It was a different story. But Amazon's not a startup company, and all of our senior executives operate the same way I do. They work in the future, they live in the future. None of the people who report to me should really be focused on the current quarter. I always tell people, sometimes I get, you know, we'll have a good quarterly conference call or something, and Wall Street will like our quarterly results, and I'll get people will stop me and say, congratulations on your quarter, and I say, thank you. But what I'm really thinking is, that quarter was baked 3 years ago. Right now, I'm working on a quarter that's going to reveal itself in 2021 sometime. And that's what you need to be doing. You need to be out sort of, you know, 2 or 3 years in advance. And if you are, and then why do I need to make 100 decisions today? If I make like 3 good decisions a day, that's enough. And they should just be as high quality as I can make them.
When you buy over the internet, Amazon, do you ever get the wrong orders? Anything ever wrong? What do you do? Do you call up and complain, or you don't have any problems?
No, I'm a customer of Amazon, hopefully like all of you in this room.
Is there one person full-time who services your account?
If there's anyone in this room who's not an Amazon customer, see me right afterwards, and I'll walk you through it. It's I have problems sometimes, and I treat them like the same way I treat a problem that I would get from a customer. My email address is famous, and I keep it, and I read it. It's jeff@amazon.com. I don't see every email that I get anymore because I get too many, but I see a lot of them. And I use my curiosity to pick out certain emails. So I'll get one from a customer, and there's a defect. You know, we've done something wrong. Usually people are writing us, not always, but usually they're writing us because we've screwed up their order somehow. And I am, so I'm looking at this, and for some reason, something seems a little odd about that one. And so I'll ask the team to do a case study and find real root cause, or causes, it's usually causes, real root causes, and then real root fixes. So that when you fix it, you're not fixing it for that one customer, you're fixing it for every customer. And that process is a gigantic part of what we do. So I would treat if I have a failed order or some bad customer experience, I would treat it just like that.
So you've revolutionized retail, as I say, but now you're in the bricks and mortar business. You bought Whole Foods.
Yeah.
What was the theory behind buying something that doesn't sell things over the internet?
We're very interested in physical stores, and we haven't. I've been asked for years, we ever open physical stores. Literally 20 years I've been asked the question, and I always say yes, but only when we have a differentiated offering, something that's not me too. Because that space, physical stores, is so well served. If we offer a Me Too product offering, it's not going to work. We're not very good at that. Whenever we've tried dabbling in something that's a Me Too service, we tend to get beaten. It doesn't work. Our culture is much better at pioneering and inventing, and so we have to have something that's different. And that's what Amazon Go is. It's completely different. The Amazon Bookstore, completely different. And we have ideas about how to merge Prime and Whole Foods to make that. Those are still rolling out. You haven't seen them yet. But to use Amazon Prime to make Whole Foods a very differentiated experience. And so what we're going to be able to do is take some of our resources, some of our technological know-how, and expand the Whole Foods mission. They have a great mission, which is to bring nourishing food to everybody, organic, nourishing food to everybody. And but you know, we have a lot to bring to that table in terms of resources, but also in terms of operational excellence and in terms of technology know-how.
Now, one of the other companies you started within your company, which is technologically a superior company, is Amazon Web Services. Where did that idea come from?
AWS. We started it, I don't know, a long time ago now, 15 years ago, and worked on it behind the scenes for a long time, and then finally launched it. It has become a very large company, at AWS, we completely reinvented the way that companies buy computation. Then a business miracle happened. This never happens. This is like the greatest piece of business luck in the history of business, so far as I know. We faced no like-minded competition for 7 years. It's unbelievable. And when I launched Amazon.com in 1995, Barnes & Noble launched BarnesandNoble.com in 1997. 2 years. That's very typical if you invent something new. We launched Kindle. Barnes & Noble launched Nook 2 years later. We launched Echo. Google launched Google Home 2 years later. When you pioneer, if you're lucky, you get a 2-year head start. Nobody gets a 7-year head start. And so that was incredible because, and I think it was a whole confluence of things. I think that the big established enterprise software companies did not see Amazon as a credible right. enterprise software company. And so we had this long runway to build this incredible little feature-rich, and it's just so far ahead of all the other products and services available to do this work today.
But do you worry that the U.S. government might come along, or the European government, some regulatory thing could come and impair your business?
No, well, not here's what I think about that. I have a couple. I get asked this question frequently.
And I thought it was an original question.
No, sorry. You do that sometimes, but that's not one of them. My view on this is very simple. All big institutions of any kind are going to be and should be examined, scrutinized, inspected. Governments should be inspected. Government institutions, big educational institutions, big nonprofits, big companies. They're going to get scrutiny. It's not personal. It's kind of what we as a society want to have happen. So that's one thing. And I remind people internally when, you know, if they don't take this personally, that will lead you in a lot of wasted energy. This is just normal. It's actually healthy. It's good. And then the second thing I think is we are so inventive that whatever regulations are promulgated or however it works, that will not stop us from serving customers. So to really, you know, I mean, under all kind of regulatory frameworks that I can imagine, customers are still going to want low prices. They're still going to want fast delivery. They're still going to want big selection. It's really important that politicians and others they need to understand the value that big companies bring and not demonize or vilify business in general, or especially not business. Well, they shouldn't vilify big companies, and they shouldn't vilify business in general, for sure. And the reason is simple. There are certain things only big companies can do. I love, you know, garage entrepreneurs. I invest in a lot of their companies. I know many of them. But nobody in their garage is going to build an all carbon fiber, fuel efficient Boeing 787. It's not going to happen. You need Boeing to do that. This world would be really bad without Boeing and without Apple and without Samsung and so on.
One of your passions is not just Amazon, but it's outer space and space travel and Blue Origin. So you've started Blue Origin a little bit in secret, then you've made it public. You're putting $1 billion or more of your own personal capital into it every year.
Next year it'll be more for the first time.
All right. And what are you going to get out of it? Are we going to have people going into space? What is the purpose?
Yeah. This is the most important work I'm doing, and I have great conviction about that. It is... it's a simple argument. This is the best planet. We have now sent robotic probes to every planet in this solar system. Believe me, this is the good one. My friends who say they want to move to Mars, I say, look, do me a favor, move to the top of Mount Everest for a year first, because that's a garden paradise compared to Mars. And so this gem of a planet, we're finally, as a species, big enough to really impact it. And so, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, Earth was really big and humanity was really small. That's not true anymore. And so we face a choice as we move forward. We're going to have to decide whether we want a civilization of stasis, which we could do. That's a legitimate choice. What does it mean? It means we will have to cap population. We will have to cap energy usage per capita. So people don't think about how much energy they use. It takes a lot of energy. And so do you want that to continue for your grandchildren and your grandchildren's grandchildren? In other words, I want my grandchildren's grandchildren to be using way more energy per capita than I am. And I would like to see not have a population cap. I wish there were 1 trillion humans in the solar system. Then there would be 1,000 Einsteins and 1,000 Mozarts. But we don't have that long. So there's all sorts of problems that we are about to face, because for the first time in our civilizational history, going back thousands of years, we're now big compared to the size of the planet. We can fix that problem, but we can fix it in exactly one way, by moving out into the solar system. My role in that is I want to build reusable space vehicles. That's the heavy lifting. Amazon was able to get started with only $1 million in capital. And because I got to ride on the back of the credit card system, I got to ride on the back of the pre-existing transportation network that could deliver packages, the pre-existing telecommunications network that could allow people to connect to our servers, all of that would have been hundreds of billions of dollars in CapEx, but the heavy lifting was already in place. And that's what allowed Facebook, if you think about it, two kids in a dorm room made this $500 billion market cap company in an incredibly less than two decades. That's unbelievable. And so, but that can't happen in space. There's no way two kids in a dorm room can start a space company of any significance because the price of admission is so high. And so I want to build space infrastructure so that the next generations of people can use that infrastructure the same way I used UPS and FedEx and so on to build Amazon. So that's what Blue Origin is all about.
So do you ultimately want that to be your legacy or Amazon? And what would you like to have as your legacy?
World's oldest man. That's a famous line I like. But the real thing is, it'll be whatever it's going to be. I'm going to be proud of the things. I live my life in such a way that when I, in a quiet moment of reflection, and I'm thinking back on my life, that I have as few regrets as possible. And I don't, what will my legacy be? I have no idea. And I don't even want to spend a lot of time thinking about it.
Do you intend to give away the bulk of your fortune at some point in your lifetime?
I intend to give away, I don't know how much of it I'm going to give away. I'm going to give away a lot of money in a nonprofit model, but I'm also going to invest a lot of money and something that any rational investor would say is a really bad investment, which is Blue Origin, but I think it's super important. And if I can't make Blue Origin a for-profit thing, maybe I'll convert it to nonprofit at some distant point in the future. But that would be, I wouldn't want that. I want it to be a thriving ecosystem, more like UPS and FedEx.
So let's just close with your wife. We haven't mentioned her yet.
Yeah, we met in New York City at DE Shaw & Co., where we worked. We got engaged. We dated for 3 months. We were engaged for 3 months, and then got married. So our whole kind of dating engagement period was only 6 months long. I would like to take a moment to talk about my parents, if that's okay. You didn't ask me, but I would like to. They're here in the audience, and my parents are. I thank you guys. You get different gifts in life, and one of the great gifts I got is my mom and dad. It's amazing. My highest admiration is withheld for those people, and we all know some of them, I know several of them, who had terrible parents. Maybe they were abusive, whatever it is. And some of those people who so admirably break that cycle and pull out and make that all work, I did not have that situation. I was always loved. My parents loved me unconditionally, and by the way, it was pretty tough for them. You know, she doesn't talk about it that much, but my mom had me when she was 17 years old. She was a high school student in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You could ask her, but I'm pretty sure that wasn't cool in 1964 to be a pregnant mom in high school in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And in fact, my grandfather, who is another incredibly important figure in my life, went to bat for her, and because the high school wanted to kick her out. You weren't allowed to be pregnant in high school there. And my grandfather said, you can't kick her out. It's a public school. She gets to go to school. And they negotiated for a while. And the principal finally said, okay, she can stay and finish high school, but she can't do any extracurricular activities, and she can't have a locker. And I know. And my grandfather, being a very wise man, he was like, done, we'll take that deal. And so she finished high school, she had me, and then she married my dad. My dad is my real dad, not my biological dad. His name is Mike. He's a Cuban immigrant, got a scholarship to college in Albuquerque, which is where he met my mom. So I have a kind of a fairy tale story. And my grandfather, possibly because, I mean, I'm pretty sure because my parents were so young, starting at age four, he would take me every summer on his ranch. And it was the most spectacular. From age 4 to 16, I basically spent every summer working alongside him on the ranch. He was the most resourceful man. He would he did all his own veterinary work. He would even make his own needles. He would pound the wire with an oxyacetylene torch and drill a little hole in it and sharpen it and make a suture, like make a needle that he could suture up the cattle with. Some of the cattle even survived. And he was a remarkable man and a huge part of all of our lives. But it is, you don't realize, you know, you just look back and, you know, if you don't have these parents, you know, it's so important. So it's just a really big deal. And my grandfather, too, he was like a second set of parents for me.